This is the European edition of Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show. We bring you the European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders innovating the rapidly evolving fintech scene today. A truly localized podcast with both English and local language content with some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in the fintech sector globally. Join us every week as we explore what makes the European Union a phenomenal proving ground for many of the fastest growing fintech plays in the world today. Okay, let's roll.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Breaking Banks Europe. This is episode 49 of our podcast. I'm Francesca Liverti, and I will be your host for this session. Today, we are here actually with our monthly segment in which we give voice to some of the most recognizable voices in the industry. And we are going to discuss some of the current news of the fintech ecosystem. But first of all, let me welcome our three guests of today. We have the amazing Gela Boscovic, one of the biggest gurus and busy speaker in the industry. Welcome, Gela.
Thank you, Francesca. Great to be here.
Also in the show, it's my pleasure to introduce you for the first time, actually, in the podcast, Alessandro Atami, Managing Partner at Pacemakers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
And last but certainly not least, online from Barcelona, I suppose, a very well-known face of this format, former Swift CEO and founder of FTS Group, Lazaro Campos. Welcome, Lazaro.
Good morning. Thank you, Francesca. And good morning, everybody. Great to be here.
All right. Although it might be a bit redundant, since I believe everybody in the fintech ecosystem knows you, let's follow the rules. And I'd like to ask each of you to tell us a couple of words about yourself, your current activities, your background, really in a nutshell. Gela, maybe do you want to start?
I'd be delighted to. Thanks. The name is Gela Boscovic. The mugshot and rap sheet are currently protected under GDPR. Thank you very much. But I am the head of the Financial Data and Technology Association in Europe. We focus on advocating and lobbying for policy that enables open banking to truly take root, and with an eye on legislation and policy for open finance, which brings all of a consumer's and small business and even corporates' data into a holistic view so they can see the actual value of their financial position and leverage the new technologies and offerings on the market that allow them to maximize the economic value of their money. So everything in my world these days is around open banking and open finance.
Great. Thanks, Gela. Alessandro.
Thank you very much, Francesca. So I'm the founder of Pacemakers. Pacemakers is a company that was created a few years ago, not that many, to help large corporates innovate by finding the right partner. So we realize that financial transformation is possible and necessary for banks, but most of them don't have the right skills, so they need to find the right partner. So we created Pacemakers to act almost like a headhunter to help them find the right companies to work with. And we're doing, interestingly, it's the business is growing and we're quite happy with that. Background-wise, I started in fintech in 1999 when G Capital's first website. Then I was employee 11 at PayPal in the UK, the CEO of PayPoint.net, and the CEO of digital banking at the Lloyds Banking Group. I'm also a non-executive director at Bank Challenger, soon to be Challenger Bank Cash Plus. I'm an advisor to the board of MTS in Russia and an investor in a variety of several fintechs, including Curve, the Curve Card. I've also write, and my book, co-written with a very good friend, is coming out in the next few days, the beginning of November, and it's called Reinventing Banking, and I urge everybody to look for it on Amazon. Thank you very
good
much.
Good to hear, of course. Thanks. That was a good one.
good plug.
Yes. Lazaro, your turn.
Yeah, good morning. So what in fintech stage, what we do is this help organizations in their innovation journeys, find partners, find startups they can work with. We do that in a number of fields, as broad as from insurance to financial inclusion across the world. In addition, in the board of a number of fintechs, Challenger Bank in the UK, I mean, board of the Bank of England, looking at payment infrastructure and the transformation that's going on in the UK. And prior to that, as Francesca alluded to, I worked for Swift many years in different functions, and I left 8 years ago now, and I was CEO of the company for some 6 years. And that's great. That. And no mugshots, no t-shirts, and I haven't written them.
Let's talk about it.
You never know, Lazar. There is always plenty of time. All right. So after this introduction, I think we have we made the right choices in calling you for sure. So guys, let's jump directly into the conversation. And as I was saying at the beginning, in this format, we have selected three news I want to discuss with you. And the first one is actually, allow me to say, the too big not to talk about it. And it's about the Wirecard scandal. So when it happened, some commentators said it would have impacted the whole sector. Of course, I want to hear your opinion on that. But most of all, I'd like to focus on the open gaps that the ruin of Wirecard left. So it's clear to everybody that from the fall of that emerged an opportunity for one payment provider, or maybe more than one payment provider, to replace Wirecard and become the market leader. So the main question is, who do you think is going to fill some of the $30 billion void left by Wirecard? And I mean, we see a couple of interesting players. I spent a lot of years in the Netherlands, so I'm going to mention Adyen or Molly. We just raised 106 million euros. Although they have different business models than Wirecard. And of course, I cannot forget Railsbank, who is planning to leverage Wirecard, the UK asset, to expand globally. So can you guys help us put a bit more clarity around this landscape? And do you actually maybe see that the consequences of what happened are still far to be fully understood, or what? What do you think? Who wanna start?
Lazaro, go for it. It's a touchy subject. Let's start out with the diplomatic answer.
So I guess, Francesca, is yes to everything you've said, right? So clearly this has shaken the market for a number of reasons. It's shaken the market because it's been a surprise, a significant surprise that nobody was expecting. And then when you start listening to the news and Ernst & Young were there, and had been, you know, aware of the issues for a fair amount of time, a whistleblower within the company. When you see that we thought we were protected and regulation is really not working for us. And now there seems to be even a political ramification to the backlash. So yes, this is going to have a profound impact. Now, does this mean that we are going to see a consolidation of the sector? I don't think so. I think fragmentation in the payments business is there to stay. There will be more or less or bigger or smaller organizations that change position within the top 10 rank. But this is, I think, that this is unlikely to trigger a concentration on the market. These will have regulatory implications, and Gela is close to those, and I'm sure Alessandro can tell it, write another book on that. So there's going to be a review of how did we get here. There's going to be a review of what payment providers can and cannot do and the transparency of how they operate, and a real test of infrastructure, which is what your comment on Railsbank, right? So they want to... The UK entity of Wirecard was significantly, I mean, everybody was using at some point Wirecard in the UK. So there are huge ramifications that the FCA, that the regulators in the UK were very quick to stop and then reopen, because it would have created a significant issue in the UK had they not reacted very quickly. And measure their reaction to the Wirecard issue. So that's opening remarks. I hope they were suitably politically appropriate, Gela, so you can now counter.
Well, thanks, Lazaro. I tend to agree, especially with the regulatory reaction. It was swift. The FCA was between a rock and a hard place, in part because it's about protecting consumers who had payments that were yet to be processed and would have been lost in the system, and for those merchants who are on the receiving end. I mean, it is systemically significant to a certain extent. It's not as if it were all of the payments in the UK being put on a stop, but there's a significant portion. The interesting thing is it's brought up a lot of discussion on the future of regulation for payment processing for the payment systems. And the Treasury is actually just finishing up a consultation. It closes tomorrow on the payment landscape and what that should look like, including what levels of license may need to be in place for us to avoid another Wirecard scandal or another situation where it opens the entire payment processing or the payment system to some significant risk with a singular player or a singular significant player taking a dominant position in the market. I think what's interesting is that Rails Bank has definitely looked at this as an opportunity. They've certainly employed a number of former Wirecard employees. They look at this as a talent play. Not necessarily, and Wirecard is not necessarily a reflection of the talent that they employed earlier. But they're also kind of in an interesting position in Singapore and moving quickly into Asia in order to fill this gap and to take up the role of payment processing for Singapore, which was significantly affected by this as well. So I think there are opportunities for other infrastructure players or payment service providers to slip in and to take up some of that market share. On the other hand, I don't think that there is any move to stymie the growth of those potential alternatives either. When we're looking at a non-lending banking license and you know, the sort of balance sheet that one has to carry in order to cover the risk and the spread, I think there is an opportunity for regulators to come in and adjust the different levels of regulatory supervision for different players and their permissions, but also to encourage this fractionalization to exist, because it also prompts more competition across the market and it drives a bit better innovation, it drives a bit better refinement of the business model itself, and the value chain itself expands. So there's opportunity for economic growth rather than economic retraction, even though you see a player fail. So I do think what did Einstein say, that in every catastrophe or every challenge, there is always opportunity. And I think that a lot of these players are looking at this as a once-in-a-lifetime move for them to expand and grab some market share as they go.
Yeah. Definitely. What's your opinion, Alessandro?
I agree with both Lazaro and Gela. I think the analysis is very clear. I think there's a fundamental learning from this crisis is that the systems that we have in place for managing and supervising financial services are not adequate. And the way BaFin reacted to the FT article about Wirecard, in fact, they accepted the perspective that Wirecard was telling them that these people are trying to play to the game of a short sellers, and they tried to prosecute the two journalists that wrote that is a terrible indictment on the way BaFin operates, BaFin being the German regulator. And what happened is that because the German regulator was so adamant that this was not a situation of a fraudulent company, other regulators across the globe also kind of said, in part agreed, because one of their peers was seeing in that perspective. So I think we need to realize that regulators are possibly not fit for purpose yet, or they need to develop skills that are not currently available to them. So we are seeing a giant like Wirecard get through the net in a way that is unacceptable, frankly. In parallel to that, you get the service providers that support that regulation, which is the auditors, which did an appallingly poor job. So EY did not think to check into the Filipino bank that was supposedly holding this 1.8 billion assets. And it's scary that they thought that was good enough to do that. And in fact, even now there's KPMG being involved because they, I think they audited another division of Wirecard and they were not, they did not detect that there was fraudulent problem. But, you know, little things like, for example, the management team claim to have very advanced technological proposition, their technological tools to monitor the business, but their central CRM tool for understanding how their customers operate was an Excel spreadsheet. Should have alerted people that this is a challenge. So I think that the main impact I think of Wirecard will be that of regulators realizing that they're not attacking this proposition, this problem in the right way. That said, the FCA responded very, very fast. When they realized that it was a problem, they responded very, very fast. They sent alerts to all the companies that were working with Wirecard, and lots of companies switched from different providers. So I think hats off to the FCA response, but I think overall we need to keep an eye on what's going on with regulation. The discussion about competition, I think I agree again with both Lazar and Gela, there will be more competition. This is not going to be a consolidation opportunity. I think this will be a reason for companies to actually become more clear, more explicit about the quality of their proposition. And therefore, consolidation may not be the natural outcome of this. We will see key niche players that will have to be a lot more open about how they're operated in the past than ever before. But at the same time, consolidation may not be the most obvious outcome of the Wirecard.
Yeah, it's kind of unbelievable that such a big thing can be possible. And indeed, the regulation impact, as you all were saying, is going to be the big one, pumping a bit more fragmentation instead of one single player prevailing, which is always good for the competition, let's say. So let's keep talking about the payment war, and I want to focus on another interesting topic that was out in the news in the last couple of days. And I'd like to call it the credit game, let's say, played by a bunch of credit card providers, but also e-commerce players. So in the last days we had, and I'm glad actually Alessandro is here because of his background in PayPal. So PayPal, yeah, I'm sorry. So PayPal Pay in 3, which is the new PayPal service that offers the possibility to make purchases by paying over 3 interest-free payments. Amex also announced a new co-branded credit card in partnership with Amazon Business. And Klarna that announced its partnership with Macy's to offer consumers to pay in 4 interest-free installments at the online checkout. So I've selected these random and most recent 3, but to be honest, we were quite full of similar news about the buy now and pay later partnerships in the last months. And this, I think, is a sign that we are now seeing an acceleration of deferral payments that is also partially influenced, I think, by the changing needs of the consumers as a result, probably also of the pandemic. And I mean, it makes total sense in order to probably overcome actually the tight financial situation. But I was wondering more about the societal effects that this could have. I mean, this is probably a bit more about behavioral economics, or how do you want to call it. But don't you think that following this path could lead actually to an uncontrolled use of personal financial resources, or shouldn't we focus more on promoting a responsible financial behavior among people? I'm really curious to hear your opinion on this.
I'll kick this off as you said. You wanted to. Oh, sorry, Gela, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I was going to say this. I've had experience, you know, over the years. This buy now, pay later format has been in existence, especially in the States, for a number of years, and I may have I probably have a very different look on it from a personal behavior perspective. But Alessandro, give us the business rationale for this, and then I'll give you examples of how it's actually affected my life and how we see it a little bit differently.
Absolutely. I think the business rationale is making more money. So very simply. PayPal tried to do something like this many years ago. It was called Bill Me Later. which did not succeed. The rates were quite high. There was a bank in the States that was providing the service. You would buy something on PayPal and you would click on bill me later, and it would not come directly from your balance, but you'd get a credit line provided to you. Now, what's different about what the Klarnas of this world are doing, what PayPal is doing right now, and even potentially Affirm is doing in the States, to mention a few other names, is that this is a slightly different product. So this, the credit side of this product is actually paid by the merchant, by the retailer. So especially as far as if you look at Klarna, and there's a big debate about this right now in the UK about the regulation of this, the consumer is not seen as a borrower. The consumer actually gets this credit line. It's the cost of this credit line is paid by the retailer. And the consumer then, at the end of the period, if they pay back entirely, they have not borrowed at all against it. Interestingly, if they don't pay for it, they just go straight into collections and it doesn't become a credit product if they refuse to pay, which allows Klarna not to be regulated by the FCA as a lending, as a credit institution, which is something that there's a lot of debate happening right now. That said, this is not a new product. As Gila was saying, it's just in the States. It's quite common in France. If you look at One, the bank of the Auchan Group, they've been providing it for years. They call it 3X, 4X One, and they provide that. It's an interesting product that is de facto, as you said, a credit product, but it falls through the cracks. It's not really regulated as such.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting to understand more what Gela was saying about her experience and the fact you have a different opinion on this, right?
Well, I've used it, so I'm familiar with this model in terms of, you know, three payment installations, and then afterwards, if you don't pay in full, it goes on to a credit line where you're charged a significant amount of interest. And it's offered via the merchant. It's not offered by a financial institution directly to the consumer. It's done through a middleman, and the intermediary, like Alessandra said, is the merchant. It's them extending credit to the customer. I see it very often in furniture and housewares and electronics. We're seeing it with Apple, you know, being able to pay in a certain number of installations. And it does make sense for consumers who are aware of the impact if the repayment doesn't happen in the set time frame. But it's almost considered usury after, you know, the third payment or the fourth payment. After that point, if the balance remains, it's a really, really significant annual percentage rate. We're talking 20, 25, 30%. But for those consumers who are financially aware and are financially, let's put it this way, active in budgeting, it is a way to extend a zero credit opportunity for a moment, but it's not seen as a credit product. And the problem is it has very significant impact on credit histories post the time frame of the payment agreement. I do see it as useful. It's sort of point of sale credit, but point of sale credit deferred. It unfortunately, though, has a significant negative impact for consumers who look at it as a payday loan, or they look at it as a spot finance that allows them to consume without responsibility for a set amount of time. The problem is that the terms and conditions are not explicitly necessarily pointed out to the consumer at the point of sale moment. It also is something that could be better managed with the use of payment initiation services and some of the functionality like a variable recurring payment, where we know very well that the merchant can initiate that on behalf, a request to pay on behalf of the consumer, and they can facilitate the fulfillment of the agreement without the penalties. But those particular types of use cases are not yet delivered to market. And they would actually transform this into a really good, functional way of allowing those consumers on the lower end of the credit spectrum to manage budget and fulfill the terms and not be penalized. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And we're seeing in open banking that we could probably bring something like this, pay now, pay later, that is beneficial to the end consumer, that actually allows the merchant to move their goods and services, but and anticipate their own cash flow by being able to initiate those payments on behalf of those customers and leverage that particular functionality under open banking. But that's not yet the case. So I've used them. I've used them to my own benefit because I understood that, you know, I didn't want to pay an interest rate. But I do see that it's the same sort of promotion of exacerbated credit and debt and leveraging debt over the course of time for end consumers. I think that if there were different regulation around the credit providers and to actually look at the banks that are underwriting the merchants, the acquirers themselves, that that would be a different, that that would lend a different consumer protection overlay. That could be quite an interesting approach. But if it's not supervised and if it's not put in place in soon, we're going to see that it's as exploitative and definitely damaging to the overall consumption, credit, debt scenario that we live in right now. I think in terms of this being popular during COVID, it is because people are looking at their budgets a little bit more closely. We're all, I think, hyper aware of our own positions. Whether or not this now starts to affect consumer behavior in terms of slowing consumption, but slowing it in such a, well, let me put it this way, accelerating consumption because the market requires consumption to continue to churn. Okay. But does it in a way that doesn't negatively impact the credit and risk profile of the end consumer? That could be interesting. But I don't see it actually being that way because there isn't a framework in place to A, protect consumers, B, leverage good behavior under open banking using those payment initiation functionalities and use cases because they're not delivered yet, at least for Europe and for the UK. And secondly, or thirdly, I suppose, is the terms and conditions are not incredibly clear and have a chance to do much more harm than good.
Yeah. I mean, the main concern is always about people that are not completely aware of what they are buying. But as you were saying, actually, if the framework they put in and it's clear enough, then it could actually be quite a boost or a good product that the people that are aware can benefit from. Lazaro, well, go ahead, Dila.
Sorry, Lazaro. No, I was just thinking, I mean, I think it's interesting that American Express with Amazon, right? That's small business. That's
for small business.
It's a different. Yeah. It's a exactly. different use case, and it's underwriting the merchant. But I think that's a better proposition in the sense that it's used for supply chain and trade finance to move goods and services in an environment under the pandemic that has been dampered. I think that when you're doing direct to consumer, it's a little more risky. So I find the Amazon small business proposition from Amex a little bit more interesting and probably less damaging to the overall market itself. But I do see direct consumer a little hesitant.
Problem. Yeah. Lazaro, before I ask your opinion, we are going to go for a very short break and we will be back in a couple of minutes.
I'll wait patiently.
The FTS Group builds innovation ecosystems. We engage incumbents, investors, entrepreneurs, technology partners, and regulators to build trusted and connected fintech tribes around the world. We firmly believe that innovation in financial services will truly improve people's lives. Learn more on ftsgroup.eu.
Here we are back into the conversation, and Lazaro was actually about to give us his opinion about the buy now, pay later phenomenon and the impact that this might have. Lazaro, all yours.
Yeah, thank you, Francesca, and thank you. I won't add much. I think that a combination of what Alessandro said, Angela. So you find here a product, what is a credit product disguised as a different kind of product that is not a credit product and does not have the same protections or the same information need to the customer. So it looks like a very interesting customer-centric play, but the customer is not fully aware of the consequences of using the product, and they are not informed of the negative effects that it can have should they fail to pay. So I think that the issue here is one of information and one of making sure that whenever you do decide to do this, it's just not click away, but they actually understand the consequences. And those consequences can be dire. So great news for the consumer if, you know, used properly, but that information is not disclosed as readily as it should be. And then coupling it with Gela's view on open banking, it would be even more powerful if obviously these products and this innovation would take into account the totality of the customer and the risk profile of the customer and differentiate not only pricing but also conditions for the different customers based on the information the customers readily would offer, because open banking makes that a possibility to actually disclose your details in exchange of something. So you now are in charge and control your data and can use it to your benefit in specific cases. I think those are the headlines of what I heard and I agree with. For the rest, I think your point, Francesca, of better financial behavior, financial education for people, yeah, that's absolutely essential. And I think all providers have a responsibility to be clear to potential customers on what is it that they are offering and what is it, what are the real conditions in clear English.
Yeah.
Interesting. Can I also
Yeah, of course.
That. I think one of the interesting things about what Klarna is doing is that the proposition is different from country to country. So if you look at the US and exactly what Gela was saying, they do charge a fee if you don't pay. In the UK,
because
they
probably
don't.
They know the attitude or the behavior is different country by country or what?
Yeah, it's actually that they're trying to get away from regulation. So if you look at what this says in the UK, if you go, what happens if I don't pay my order on Klarna UK? It says we will try to get payment for two times and then nothing. Okay.
All right.
We will make another attempt and further 7 days, 14 days after you attend, and then nothing. Okay. Then it says your credit scores will not be impacted by using Klarna installment product, even if you have failed to pay on time, which means it's not a credit product. That said, they do send it to bailiffs. So there's people coming to your door, knocking on your door saying you have to pay. Okay. Which is a really kind of ambiguous choice for a product that is ultimately a credit product. And in this situation where people actually are finding themselves in financial need potentially, and as Gela was saying, and Lazar was saying, this is a credit product that sometimes helps people in situations where COVID has put them in difficult financial place. This product is a bit irresponsible, as you were saying. Okay, it's a bit unclear what the proposition is, which is, I think is something that a regulator should not allow. So that's my two pennies worth.
Alessandro, you're absolutely right. It's a payment product. It's advertised as a payment product, but it essentially is a line of credit, even if it's a short time-bound line of credit. It's fundamentally that. So I do think there's zero truth in lending in terms of how it's advertised. Mm-hmm. I do think there are... when we're looking at credit cards, for example, there are consumer protections in place and there's an understanding that you pay for that extent, you pay for the line of credit. When it comes down to the payment product as it's advertised, that isn't the case. It's not exactly a payment product, but that's how it's put out to market. And I think that disconnect has a potentially damaging effect on and consumers across the board. And like you say, if you know, depending on the country where the offering is in place, the consequences of failure to pay can be completely alien or completely foreign to what the advertised product is. So unless there is explicit consumer education around it, or there is explicit terms and conditions that are easy to digest, and most regulators want those terms and conditions and product design to be fairly transparent to consumers, I think it's a misplay. And I know they'll have incredible uptake. I mean, this is an attractive offering for those who don't understand that this is essentially credit, but they look at it as a payment option. I think, again, if it were positioned or crafted under true open banking, it would have a very different look, and it could have a very different different outcome when we match it with payment initiation services, but that's not the case. And those offerings don't exist in the countries or the markets where these are in play at the moment. So I do think it's a bit of a dangerous snake oil, to be quite frank.
Yeah,
and I mean, this is actually the main problem. I mean, how the product is advertised to the end consumer is probably a bit misleading of what it is for real. So it's indeed a matter of transparency. And then on the other side of a consumer, there is not enough aware of what they are buying or getting. And keep talking about financial education and awareness. There is another theme that I'd like to briefly discuss with you, and that got me quite triggered by the concept of social finance. And I'm referring in particular to the recent initiative by SoFi, the digital personal finance company, that just launched a new social trading and investing feature within SoFi Invest, which includes the ability to follow friends, family, other members in their investing journey. And I mean, as a young, not even 30 years old person, I do believe that these initiatives are actually quite a good boost to the concept of investing, especially among young people. Because many times, you know, it drives me a bit crazy to see so many times too much liquidity. And I'm not talking about only young people, of course, but too much liquidity forgotten in the bank accounts because of still too high a risk aversion towards investment, or even in this case, a lack of financial education, perhaps. So first of all, I want to ask you if what I'm saying, do you relate with what I'm saying? And also, why do you think this behavior is so rooted in so many places still? And yeah, in general, if you think that this kind of solution could probably increase people's willingness to invest earlier and consistently, perhaps. What do you think?
Can I start on that one? When I was at Lloyd's, we explored the idea of doing something where we told people like you invest like this. Mm-hmm. Because we realized that after there's a regulation in the UK called RDR, which forces the banks to clearly describe how much the advice that they're giving to their customer costs. And it turns out that is a very big part of the investment return is taken up by the advice side. So what this resulted in is that RDR got removed. People said, I'm not going to pay my bank to give me advice. So they started underinvesting. And this was a big problem because the people didn't know what to do with their money. And the description that you had of people are leaving money and their balances was exactly that. So we thought, why don't we do something that we go and do people like you invest like this? And it turns out that it was impossible to do that because when we started doing the analysis, most people actually are underinvesting. And therefore, creating a situation where people like you invest creates the perception that that is the right amount you should be investing for your pension, for your future, and so on. And in reality, if we did that, it would result in people actually not doing the right thing, but actually underutilizing their assets. Because as you said, that trend is there. So the challenge you have with using crowd advice in that is that oftentimes crowds are not right. And that is a big challenge. There are examples of crowd advice that work well. So eToro is a good example. Yep. That don't work well, but exist and are successful. I'm not sure they are right for everybody. They're definitely right for the aggressive and experienced investor. That said, it's a dangerous thing to do because if everybody in a community is not investing, that doesn't mean that's the right thing to do. What do you guys think?
Yeah, indeed. I actually think that things have changed considerably, right? I think now it's much easier to invest smaller amounts. The information is more free flowing. There is all sorts of services that allow you to make your own profile and decide how you go about investing and so on. You're right in saying that banks still see advice as a service that you pay for, and that puts people off. I'm not going to pay my bank to give me advice to sell me more stuff. Now, I think things have changed. I think there is a lot of offers. There are a lot of offers that allow you to go in and invest very little and try and test, and there is more and more information flowing. I think negative interest rates is going to be even a bigger booster for people to start investing instead of leaving money on their accounts, and that's coming. So I think that now is a real good time for real solutions to help people invest. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody gets generic cheap advice. I think that the issue here is one of, I think we will see the emerging of tailor-made solutions that take into account your profile and who you are financially. Open banking is a great platform for that to happen, and then become much more sophisticated in the type of advice, big robo or through advisors that people will get. But I can see that the perfect storm is brewing in terms of the incentives for people to start really taking more control of their finances, to the lowering of the barriers of investing. You don't have minimums anymore. You can do fractions of an, you know, that now is really, but the devil is in the detail. Again, financial education, not everybody means well, and not all services are the same. But I think that now is an interesting period where we'll see some of these more intelligent, more technology-based solutions come to the market. But that's a personal thing.
Yeah, I mean, except for the solution itself, my point was, of course, more on the lowering, indeed, the barriers towards investments, because these, I think, it's kind of giving people the possibility at least to understand what the possibilities are, what can be done, and matching your needs with the needs of people close to you, maybe could be a good way to lower these barriers. Gela, your opinion on this?
I think the SoFi offering is an interesting on ramp into investment for those who may not have taken the plunge already. I do see cultural shifts in talking about money and talking about the long-term needs, for retirement, younger people understanding what credit looks like very early, understanding what an ISA or an individual savings account or a retirement account or a 401k for those in the States, that there are introductions to this long-term financial management that are becoming more popular in terms of topic of conversation. It's no longer taboo to really talk about your money and how much you make or how much you spend and save, etc. It's not universal that we all talk about money, but I think the taboo around it is starting to diminish. And if this is an introduction to how to invest or to look at how investment opportunities are leveraged across your own social network, I think it's an interesting on-ramp to that highway investment. I do think that the proliferation of robo-advice and other offerings on the market are also starting to reduce those barriers. But Lazaro mentioned open banking, and I still go back to this. Open banking, when it expands into open finance, so right now open banking only covers payments, but open finance will extend that coverage to include savings, investment, and pensions. For example, in the UK, the pensions service is looking at a dashboard that allows someone to see a complete overview of all the pensions that they have out there, even if they don't know about them. Even bringing that information into a single point where somebody can look and say, oh, this is what I have, and then play around with what do I need in order to retire, or what will my life look like if I this is all I have, what does my life in retirement look like? And I think when you start to look at the possibilities of what open finance can do. And you combine that with budgeting tools and personal financial management, and then this fractional investment approach, and even the proliferation of environmental and sustainable investment advice or offerings, that as we start to look at ESGs, or we start to look at some of these sustainability goals and look at how we invest our money, that we're much more aware of the political ramifications of where our money is allocated if we invest, that those conversations also lift awareness, they lift education, and they lift incentive to invest. So I think anything that promotes earlier financial awareness and education, certainly earlier retirement planning, I'm all for it. And if this is one way to help socialize it, I think that's great. Whether or not this is effective, as Alessandra mentioned, my peer group may not actually have the best investment behavior. So I don't want to look to them, for example. But if it does bring me an awareness of the need to invest, then I'm better off than had I had my head stuck in the sand and were not aware. I do think that when we start to look at open finance and additional business models that are brought to market, we'll start to see that hyper-personalized, customized advice, or start the products, the securities, the bonds, et cetera, that are starting to be made that may fit someone's individual profile need. That will certainly be fantastic. But I do think that anything like this definitely serves as a introduction and an invitation to better manage money. And I happened to check my own investment account this morning, just looking at it. And making another transfer in, because I realized that I needed to up a little bit more. I needed to go back and review. Yeah. And I think for young consumers, for millennials, Gen Z, and even the younger kids, my nephews and nieces, looking at them and seeing how we can make them aware of what that looks like over the course of time. The earlier they start doing it, the better off they'll be in the long run. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's quite an interesting topic for me, because every time I'm thinking that when you talk about other topics, like takes for example health, even now in this period, everybody has an opinion on you have back pain, you should take this, you should do that. When talking about financial stuff, everybody, even if you have degree in aerospatial engineering, you're like, no, I cannot, I don't know, I want my bank to take care of that, or I'm afraid of investment, I might lose money. So it's really interesting for me to understand all these kind of behaviors, because I truly believe if you start to learn about these kind of things and get aware of what you should do or shouldn't do from an early age, then you can really make a difference in what your financial plan, your yearly or lifetime plan is going to be.
Well, I think we also need to look at...
This is becoming too personal, Francesca. We can help.
I took care of my pension when I was 18, imagine. So I think I'm kind of...
You're an outlier.
Yeah, exactly.
let me clarify what I said. When I said that I think this is a perfect storm for real solutions, what I mean is holistic solutions. Because much of what you have today is tools to invest. So they are transactional. And much of what we see here, what is investing? Well, investing, I think we are talking about, and I think Ella was going to that place, is a holistic management of your finances over time, longer period. And start early, because you need to start early. And nobody does, apart from you, Francesca. But very few people actually do that. And very few people understand what decisions and when do you need to start to make decisions and plans. So that holistic view of your finance need over time is really what now that's really, it's difficult to find good solutions. Much of what we see is really transactional, getting better, but it's really just a chunk of it, not a holistic view.
And I think we need to also address those who are underbanked or underserved or non-banked, yep. and look at the, you know, their financial health is something that we also need to worry about, because it is, it affects us. You know, my neighbor who doesn't, you know, can't make rent payment, or, you know, has to rely on payday loans to get by, that should actually be a hyper concern to me, because we'll also be paying into that pot to take care of them in the long run, and the social services that we have to worry about. And, you know, poor financial health affects every single one of us. We're interconnected in this entire global economy. And, you know, someone who's unbanked in India, I actually am affected by that, and my actions also affect them. So I think we also need to look at this as financial education, and starting earlier with kids and giving them an idea of what money looks like. I mean, when we talk about compound interest, lights go off, you know, compound interest. You mean I put 25 quid away when I'm 5 and it compounds over the course of time. And by the time I'm 50, it ends up at X amount. This is amazing. I didn't have to do anything. And, you know, helping those who are on the fringes or marginalized and are not really active members of the financial industry, don't participate in it. It's also, I think, an opportunity to help with better financial education, better financial planning, helping them understand what savings and investment looks like for them. And like Alessandra mentioned, it's this hyper-personalization that we can kind of start to envision. Even for those on the lower economic spectrum, deserve that onboard into financial health and wellness, you know, over the course of their entire lives. So I think anything that socializes understanding what finances really are, giving somebody an entire picture of what their financial position looks like, giving them a dashboard and, you know, little widgets that allow them to plan and project and put it in perspective of goals or desires or aspirations, you know, fine-tuning the language that we have to get to those different market segments that respond differently or have a different attitude towards the subject of money, that all of that will help improve over the course of time financial wellness for the majority of our, you know, the citizens. And I think anything that does that, but anything that also does it at an earlier age to kick this off. I think if SoFi had directed this not towards, you know, current millennials and their friends and families and their networks, but starting even earlier, it would have a much more significant impact. But I think they're great tools no matter what. I just think we're not looking at the scale at which it needs to be provided. And I also think we're not looking at those on the margins. And they are incredibly important members of our society that deserve the same sort of information and insight on how they can better improve their financial health through investment.
I can I just say I totally agree with that. I think the underbanked and the unbanked are very much a risk, almost a ticking bomb, considering how society is evolving. That said, the people like us investing, so looking at people like yourselves and looking at that as an example of how to invest, I think it's at least a good start, because it's better than nothing, as both Gela and Lazaro said. I think they should be complemented with what should be the right amount of investment that you as an individual should be making. And that should be almost not seen as advice, but seen as almost as an indication or like a speedometer, right? Or something that allows you to get a metric or get a measure of how you're doing, I think is fundamental. And it should be a component of the proposition that SoFi is putting into play.
Yeah, well, guys, I think we have covered quite a lot today, from payments to financial awareness, financial education now. And I actually think we can call the day. I want to personally thank you all for joining us today. And I think you gave our audience great inputs in all the three areas we touch upon. So thanks, Lazaro. Thanks, Gela. And thanks, Alessandro. I really hope to have you back in the show soon.
And thank you very much.
Thank you, Francesca. Thank you, Renata.
Yeah, thank you. Really enjoyed it.
And for our listeners, this format will be back next month. And of course, next week we have another episode of Breaking Banks Europe, which is celebrating its first year with a special 50th episode. So stay tuned. Ciao.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Banks Europe, a Provoke Media podcast in cooperation with FinTech Stage. Don't forget to tweet us out, shout out, or post to the team at Breaking Banks EU on Twitter. If there's something or someone you'd like to hear on our cast, let us know. See you next week on Breaking Banks Europe.